Ulswater. There was a tall glass with a finger of yellow liquor already on the table. A cigarette lay burnt out on the arm of a chair with 2 inches of ash curling like a grey horn. He opened a cupboard and picked up another glass and a half-empty bottle. "Arak?" He showed me the bottle. I said, "Fine." I wanted to make some gesture of goodwill. I was willing. God knows I was willing then, even though I felt sick inside. I looked around the room. In a corner on a table was the old gramophone with a broken lid and 2 cane armchairs, hansiputu, and a sofa bed by the windows. Seneca put some ice in the glass from a small fridge he had installed in the room and sloshed the liquor in. The ice cracked like a pistol shot. He then filled his own glass. We sat on the armchairs. He closed his eyes and said, "Cheers." His voice was already thickening. He didn't look at me. For a long time, we just sipped our drinks while I tried hard to think of a way of bringing us back to life. It was so hot and wasting. We just sat there like strangers. I said nothing. I couldn't help it. Then slowly he started talking, the words coming faster and louder as he spoke. In a harsh, bitter voice, he started accusing me. "You always thought I was bloody useless, didn't you?" he said. "A lackey, a sponge, the monkey in your glory parade." His eyes were half closed, the skin around them twitched. "You hated me. You hated me for intruding, for being born, for being me, for not being one of you. You thought it was all my bloody fault." I felt poison burning my lungs. Each word was wrung out of his mouth with such bitterness. Hate. I told myself he was not well. I told him, "It's all right. Take it easy." But then he shouted at me. I said, "Okay, all right." I lifted both my hands, open and empty. "I surrender. I give in." "What do you want?" I asked. "Don't fucking patronize me. I want nothing," he shouted. "I've got what I want. What the hell do you want? Why did you come?" Then he started shouting about mother, our mother, as if he thought I blamed him for her illness. Maybe I did once, but that was so far back I had put it behind me. I wanted to reach him again, so much. I came to help. What are we if we can't help each other? But anger was climbing up inside my throat. He had no right to shout at me like that, to talk like that. I felt all wired up inside. "There is nothing left," he then said quietly. "We are on our own. Until we are dead, we are on our own. You can't get away from that." He dug one hand into the other. "What about your son?" I asked. "About you?" I thought he must recognize some responsibility. But he looked at me as if he didn't know what I was talking about. He then crossed his arms tight against his chest and closed his eyes. "Just get out, will you?" he said. "Go, leave me alone." His eyes were squeezed tight. "I don't need you here. Get the fucking hell out of here," he shouted again. I wanted to smash the glass in my fist, hammer some sense into him, but I controlled myself and very carefully put the glass down on the table. My hand was shaking. My shoulders felt swollen, and the blood throbbed at the back of my head. I felt all hot again. The sweat broke out of my skin and soaked the back of my shirt. It dribbled all down my spine. Almost every single moment of frustration, every disagreement we had ever had, every argument from the most trivial over a cricket ball to the most profound over democracy, voiced and unvoiced, returned like a flood to fill me with all the fury I had ever felt about him. But I held it in. My whole body began to go numb. I was so angry with him for making it so, for his drunkenness, for his hopelessness. I could not bear to stay a minute longer. There's nothing I could do that I wouldn't later regret. I got up to go. Then he opened his eyes for a moment, and I saw something drop behind them. Just for a moment he looked vulnerable and weak, so frightened. But it quickly faded. It was too late. I walked out. I went as fast as I could with that frightened, angry look on his face clinging to me. It stuck inside and has stayed stuck. 2 days later, he was dead. He shot himself in the head. I still feel cold to think about it. When you came back from England for the funeral, no one wanted to say anything. There seemed to be no need. The coroner was kind and you had to get back to your finals. Then later when you got married here in England and settled down, I never expected to see you again. I knew there was nothing for you back home after what had happened. Only me. Your mother told me how you had said you never wanted to see her again after she remarried. I felt like writing to you then. It was not her fault. There was nothing else she could have done. She couldn't have coped alone in that house. But I didn't write. I don't know why. I suppose I was waiting for something. So when you wrote inviting me to come and meet the family and arrange for the ticket and all, I was really happy. I thought maybe there was some hope then, at least for you. You know, among my papers, I had come across a big brown scrapbook full of cuttings collected by your father. Pages were brittle, riddled with holes. The edges crumbled into yellow dust in my fingers. It had all turned into so much rubbish, good for nothing but silverfish and weevils. Everything had felt so pointless. I had been staring out at the black water while talking. When I looked back at Ranjit, I saw he was about to cry. His face was lopsided, the skin tugged down by his mouth. "But what did my father really want?" he asked. "What the hell did he think he was doing?" Ranjit's voice was so harsh. Surely he understood his father had turned into a drunk, that he had become ill, and that he had deliberately cut himself off. Ranjit seemed to want me to exonerate him, us. In the end, I said, "Your father knew what he was doing. In his own way, he knew." There wasn't anything more I could say. I sipped the beer, Ranjit's English bitter, and waited for my mouth to go numb.